Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and last night's AM 560 Republican gubernatorial debate, the last debate before this coming Tuesday's primary election. First, I got to say, great job, Mike Scott.
Yeah, Mike you Scott, did a wonderful job.
Great job. That was top notch. That's what a debate should be. It should be rough and tumble, hour and a half. The questions were good, other than Amy mischaracterizing what I said in one of her questions.
Is that why you're salty this morning?
But other than that, I'm salty every morning.
No. Yes, you are.
But other than that, it was really good, and it was tight. I thought it was a great deal, and it was great for AM 560.
And the candidates,
congratulations.
And the candidates wanted to debate and go back a little forth, and I'm like, do it. And then we'll just, you know, if it gets out of hand, Mike will take charge and we'll reel you in. But if this is your last debate before Tuesday.
Well, that's what it should be. That's what a debate should be. And then if it gets petty and silly and it goes too far down a rabbit hole, then you say, okay, we're moving to the next thing, which is exactly what happened. So, no, I thought it was good, and all four candidates had their chance to have their say. And now it's time for you to have your say. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Of course, the debate starts with the big news yesterday that Ken Griffin announced he's moving Citadel's headquarters, the massive hedge fund that he founded, moving the headquarters from Chicago to Miami, where he has a substantial footprint. He's had one for many years. There will still be Citadel employees left here, but it's the same conversation we had about Caterpillar in particular, but even Boeing, is that corporate headquarters moving out of Chicago, big companies that have been divesting from Chicago for some time, big companies that are global in scope, divesting from Chicago for some time, and then it just takes one or two more straws and the camel's back breaks and the camel relocates.
I remember when I said, I think it was 6 months ago, I was so fearful that we're going to become Detroit, and you said, you paused and you said, no, that's not going to happen until Ken Griffin and Citadel leave.
Well,
I remember you saying that.
Well, I would say it's
he's
not,
gone.
It doesn't all turn on Citadel, but it's the
1,000 jobs.
It's not even that. It's the slide, and it's everything that's built up around huge operations like Citadel, and frankly, like the exchanges. That's the key. The exchanges leave. Banking, financial services, insurance starts to leave. You know, Chicago has much more insulation than Detroit did because it's not a one-horse town. It's diversified. You know, we transitioned from meatpacking and manufacturing a long time ago, so it's more diversified. But can you see, well, and will you see a continuing hollowing out of Chicago? Yes.
But did he leave because safety issues, tax issues? Or the fact that his hand-picked candidate for Republican primary for governor, Irvin, is going to lose. I mean, the writing was on the wall. That yesterday seemed like a concession to me that he decided to make that big announcement that he's pulling out. And it was like, you know, we lost. Irvin's not going to win. It's over. I'm leaving Chicago.
Yeah, I think it's
a combination of all three.
Yeah, I think it's a combination. I mean, here's Griffin in April talking to the Wall Street Journal. If people aren't safe here, they're not going to live here. I've had multiple colleagues mugged at gunpoint. Wow. I've had a colleague stabbed on the way to work. Countless issues of burglary. I mean, that's a really a difficult backdrop with which to draw talent to your city. I told you this too. This is, you know, below the fold because he didn't make so much of a public issue of it when it was ratified, but he didn't want a casino in Chicago either. He thought that would denigrate the city. And as somebody who I don't know, probably gave $500 million in philanthropy to various Chicago cultural and civic organizations, and as well as the the bike trails and the natural investment. So
he's the richest man in Illinois.
As somebody who did all of that and then had that position with respect to the casino, I think he just sees it's just a general inhospitality to business, as well as just a general lawlessness. And you just don't see a lot of signs that there's real interest from the people via their political leaders to chart a different course. So we'll see.
And there was an attempted carjacking on his security detail. Okay, because they drive around the black, sleek SUVs.
Right.
And he has a family here. He's got children. And he lives near Chicago. He lives in the area. Everybody, some people know where he lives. Doesn't matter. But he said countless riots, mass shootings around him. You could be the richest person in the world, but if you're not safe, why would you stay here? And you have all the means and the money to leave.
The timing of it, to make the announcement after it's clear that Richard Ervin is not going to be the Republican nominee for governor, then
was weird.
More likely than not, he'll finish third. The polling that I released yesterday from Fabrizio and Lee, Trump's pollster, DC pollsters for Tony Fabrizio for 30 years. I mean, he's been pollster to many presidents. He goes back to being Bob Dole's pollster, at least. So anyway, 37 Bailey, 17 Sullivan, 14 Ervin, and then Rabine and Schimpf in single digits. So the die is pretty much cast for Tuesday. And certainly it is for Richard Ervin, who's completely upside down now.
Completely. It's over.
34-52, fave on fave.
And now I feel like if you vote for him, that's a complete waste of a vote.
So the timing of it, that's interesting I don't know. I mean, it feels a little bit like a temper tantrum, I got to say. I've said this many times on the show. I have great respect for Ken Griffin and what he's built. But he got terrible political advice. He has not demonstrated he's got great political instincts, actually. And, rather than take his lumps for having his team blow through so many red lights that they wasted his $50 million and say, well, you still have an interesting environment this year because of everything that's happening at the federal level and because of the hammering that people are taking, particularly economically, but also culturally. And I know that's something he actually has weighed in on this before, some of the stuff sort of very tepidly, but he's weighed in on the school curriculum issues and parents revolting against school boards. So with all that going on and you're $50 million in, and frankly, $50 million doesn't matter that much to you other than it's used to positive effect. You might think, I'll give it 4 months and we'll see if we can take Spalding out. This environment, who knows what could happen? The general election's 4 months away.
I feel like it was a win for Pritzker yesterday. And of course, Pritzker and Marriott Lightfoot are like, oh, don't, we still have growing industries here. Keebler's coming here for their snack division. Like, oh, great, we have snacks, Dan. Snacks for everybody. Sounds so childish because snacks are for children. But that's, of course, they had to deflect and act like, this wasn't a huge loss, which it is. And how Ken Griffin could be, why didn't he vet his candidate better? That is one thing that everybody's scratching their head on. Why? I mean, he didn't look into his past. He didn't know about the arrest of his girlfriend at the marijuana joint. I mean, just all of that.
So on Ken Griffin moving, the fact that he's moving to Miami, too, I thought Miami, or being a part of Florida, I thought that's where they had the "Don't Say Gay" law, and you've got a Neanderthal who's governor who didn't order jabs for zygotes. How could Ken Griffin move to Miami? The cultural Marxists in this town must be positively flummoxed that anybody is moving to Miami. Or there was a funny piece by Greg Hines and Cranes the other day. It's really funny, telling Chicago businesses, you know, you better take a look at what the Texas GOP is doing before you move to Texas.
Oh,
right. You know what, Greg? this is the attitude. You just can't figure out why people are moving to Florida and Texas because they're not focused on adhering to the cultural Marxist orthodoxy of the press corps and the elites that control all these institutions. I mean, it's positively comical to be warning businesses about moving to Texas, warning businesses about moving to Florida. You can warn them all you want, and you can wave goodbye as they do not heed said warnings. It's just really something. There's nothing to see here in 3-4 weeks. Boeing, Caterpillar, and Citadel. But there's nothing to see here. Everything's fine. Don't worry about it.
And Yelp is leaving, too. Yelp announced it late yesterday that they're shutting their Chicago office. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Chris, on the Dan Ryan, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. I was unable to I listened a little bit of the debate. Didn't get the chance to watch it because I was too busy working overtime to pay for the inflation and the gas,
yeah.
$90 to fill my car, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree with you, Dan. You know, you can't sit there and just say, oh, well, new businesses are moving in, Keebler's moving in, or whatever the case may be, when you have three big businesses that happen to leave within a month. That's a huge sign, and, you know, unless people wake up and actually start doing something, this town is going to be like Detroit. I have to agree with that. And, you know, your thoughts are right on the money.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Well, you know, and it's not just focus on the big glitzy businesses, the Fortune 1000 names. In 2020, $2.4 billion in net adjusted gross income moved to Florida from Illinois. It's also, you know, the people, successful people, not multi-billionaires, but people that are making 100, 150, 200, 250 grand, raising a family, supporting the local economy. Gone. $2.4 billion moved from Florida to Illinois just in 2020. That's about 300 grand per tax filer. Illinois has lost 60,000 black residents in the last decade. We talk about it here. Nobody else wants to mention it. Obviously, because the Chicago Press Corps is trying to prop up their politicians. The hollowing out of the black population in Chicago. Florida has gained 280,000 black residents in the last decade, while Illinois lost 60.
Good for them.
But they don't know that Florida's controlled by racist Republicans? Huh. Hmm. Craig Hines is probably scratching his head about that one, too. So confusing, these times we live in. Mike in Plano.
Hey, guys, I know you talked about the debate, but I wanted to thank you guys for having those congressional candidates from the 14th on yesterday. I'm in the 14th district out here in Kendall County, and this is Scott Greider territory. He's got his signs up all over the place, and it looks like he's going to win, which scares me a little bit because just listening to him speak yesterday, you could kind of tell that he's the establishment guy, and I really don't want to see him become the nominee for two words that you just mentioned, Dan. Political instincts. You know, he had the Richard Irvin endorsement. I heard him yesterday say, "Oh, I don't mind reaching across the aisle, but I won't compromise my principles." Well, what are those principles? Because that's a John Cornyn type answer. He said, "Oh, I ain't going to compromise the Second Amendment before voting for a gun control bill." And then when you listen to Greider, he sounds like he's just another one of these business conservative types, you know, lower taxes and all that stuff, which is a slam dunk issue for Republican voters. I don't really care. I care what he thinks about the social issues, and I have a feeling that he's just going to be weak on that. If we make him the nominee, we're going to hear him talk about how we need to cater to suburban women and grow a big tent, if you know what I'm saying.
Well, then don't vote for him.
Yeah. I don't think he's going to. Well, thanks for the call, Mike.
And he's a co-campaign chair for Richard Irvin.
Yeah, he tried to explain that away. I've known Scott for a long time, and I like him, but I don't think that race is over. I think Mike Coolidge, the radio guy, has run a pretty good campaign. I wouldn't be surprised to see Coolidge win that primary, but it seems to me that it will come down to Greider or Coolidge. That seems to me who's had, and from what I understand, people in the district, who's had the most presence, you know, who's run the most robust campaigns, but in this order, Coolidge and then Grider. So we'll see. Oh, and Martyr, too, especially since he's run several times now. So you build up name ID and you build up supporters. So, you know, that race, those primary where there's not a lot of money spent and it's really grassroots and you got half a dozen candidates, it's often a recipe for a surprise. So I wouldn't assume anything in 11 or 14, actually.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender, Signature Bank.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, talking about last night's AM 560 Republican gubernatorial debate, twinned with the big news yesterday that Ken Griffin is pulling Citadel out of Chicago and going down to Miami, where he already had shop set up. And
he's going to leave a small footprint here. He's keeping one office open.
Yeah.
And but the majority of the employees were told yesterday that he's taking, and he expects a majority of them to come with him and follow him to Florida.
And I think it's an amalgam of issues that have motivated his decision. He's been telegraphing this for years with respect to the city's and the state's financial mess, with respect to the lawlessness, the lack of safety, and perhaps the catastrophe that was his preferred candidate for governor's campaign, Richard Irvin. Maybe that's the last straw. Maybe he doesn't see hope to beat Pritzker. Maybe he doesn't see hope to defeat Lightfoot next year. And so it's time to pull the ripcord. That's what Ken Griffin seems to indicate. But I do have to say, you know, he has no one to blame but his own people. Kasen Carter, his gatekeeper. I mean, these names don't mean anything to you, nor should they, but it's just naming names because that's what we should do. Mike Z and the rest of the Rahner consultants, including Irvin's running mate, Avery Bourne, who is a Rahner toady, when she was a member of the General Assembly, is a member of General Assembly, since she's been a member of the General Assembly. This was their play. This was what they pitched. This is what Ken Griffin's gatekeeper signed off on, and they blew through all the red lights that you can blow through.
How did they let that happen?
And while they were doing that, they had a schizophrenic campaign that started with lies and then tried to cover up the old lies with new lies. And after running a similar campaign in 2018 against Jeannie Ives and barely surviving with an incumbent governor who had 4 years of fighting Mike Madigan and came to the table with some street cred with conservative primary voters, street cred that Richard Irvin didn't have, it caught up to him. Because when you're a bad actor, it catches up to you. And so I just say that because if, Ken wants to voice his frustrations and express his dissatisfaction, whether he thinks Darren Bailey can be Pritzker or not, the fact that your people did this with your money and sullied your name in the process, that's on you, man. They're your people. Those are the checks you wrote based on the advice you were given. These are the decisions that were made. And so you got to own them like everybody else has to own their decisions. Just because you're a billionaire doesn't mean you get to avoid accountability and just point fingers and take your ball and go to Miami and say, you know, you did it. No, sorry. You did it.
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line. You can also reach us via text at 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
And just to punctuate the dishonesty, you know, the scuttlebutt now and the finger pointing, this is how unseemly some of these people are. This is what low character the people who made these recommendations, who've run these campaigns, are. So now they're putting out to try to cover their tracks. They throw up their hand and have a bit of a snit. In a Capital Facts, from what I'm being told, Griffin, who was already looking at leaving, decided to hang it up when he saw Dick Uihlein so willing to team up with Governor Pritzker. The party at that point was just not worth saving. You know,
what?
But this is
Rich
what
Miller.
This is what they do. I'm talking about the consultants that are trying to spin this. The idea that Dick Uihlein would team up with any socialist, starting with Spalding, is laughable.
It's a joke.
And by the way, I know him. Obviously, he's the financier of the super PAC that I ran that focused on telling the truth about Richard Irvin, the ads you may have seen or heard on these airwaves. So
it's just a bold-faced lie.
And a lot of other people know him, too. But that's how sad and pathetic these people are. And so why they've been entrusted with so much for so long continues to baffle me. I guess people of low character congregate. Unfortunately, they've congregated in the leadership of the Republican Party for the last couple of generations. And now, perhaps a new day dawning on Tuesday, you have the opportunity to finally move some of these people to the side. Even if you can't move them out altogether, you move them to the side. And if they want to be Quislings, if they want to continue throwing in with the left, that's who actually throws in with the left. It's a little bit of projection, like the entire Irvin campaign was projection onto other people, what he is. Go ahead. Because here's the thing. I was thinking about this over the last couple of days as we move into the final stretch here. The David Mamet comment on Adam Carolla's podcast from a few weeks ago that we played, where he talked about, you know, what the cultural Marxists really fear, what they're deathly afraid of, being irrelevant. And let me tell you something. The surrender Republicans, the 30 pieces of silver Republicans in this state, the leadership of both caucuses in the House and the Senate, they're deathly afraid of being irrelevant. And this is the opportunity you have. And you move them to the side, and then you bring new leadership forward and a new attitude and new candidates. And maybe you get a new party, and maybe you get a new party that helps to usher in a new state, or at least a new direction for the state. Mm-hmm. Story of my life, since I quoted New Direction.
Right. Yeah.
So anyway, that's where we're at. And so it's actually, to me, it's a more exciting time in Illinois and within Illinois Republican ranks than a long time. It's a more exciting time than it's been to slog it out with, you're trying to work around these enemies inside our perimeter for, I don't know, the last 10 years in particular that I've been doing it. And that includes some of these self-styled donor leaders who actually just like fold in wherever Ken Griffin goes, or just do the same old thing, looking for Jim Edgar, or trying to literally break him out of the emergency glass and have him run for every statewide office that's open every cycle for the last 25 years. I mean, they're a joke. They're a joke. And maybe finally in this primary, they've been exposed as the joke that they are. And it's exciting. And you should be excited because there's opportunity here. And as I said, based on what's happening nationally, there's opportunity even in Illinois in a general, even though it will be uphill in Illinois, just as it's going to be uphill in other deep blue states. Illinois has become that. I don't think it's inexorable that Illinois stays that, but you got to seize opportunities when they present themselves. That's for sure. Lewis on the South Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. I think we've been played. Ken Griffin, he knew what he was doing. We saw this play in a movie. It's called Trading Places with Eddie Griffin. Who was that?
Eddie Murphy. Yeah, Eddie Murphy.
Eddie Murphy.
Never
and,
confused
and,
with Eddie Griffin.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd.
Yeah.
They sought out Richard Irvin. They knew what his background was. They knew how he had voted. He was behind the Black Lives Matter and all this. They sought him out. They was looking to replace he's an undesirable. They was looking to replace him.
Yeah, I would get the Trading Places storyline. The Duke brothers make their dollar bet. I can guarantee you there was no dollar bet between Ken Griffin and Dick Uihlein. Thanks for the
but
call,
But you
Lewis.
Think he would at least wait till after Tuesday's primary. But no,
yeah.
He probably saw the writing on the wall.
Well, he sees the writing on the wall. There's no question. Yeah. I think he wants to make this about things other than this catastrophe that he's underwritten. And as I said, look at all the blame shifting that is being attempted right now. Mm-hmm. Tom in Deer Park.
Good morning. With redistricting in Deer Park, we find ourselves back in the Illinois 5th, which is incumbent with Mike Wrigley.
Yeah, it's my district.
Go back a long time when Mike Flanagan beat Dan Rostenkowski. Other than that, it's been solid D. Dan, there's two candidates, Hanson and McGonigal, and the Republican primary. Be curious to your thoughts.
Is that your district, Amy? Thanks for the
call.
Yeah,
it's my sister's district, too. They changed it. So it goes from Chicago all the way out to parts of Arlington Heights, Buffalo Grove. It's crazy.
Okay, so who?
I have not taken a look at either of those two Republicans that are running. Normally one Republican runs, and sometimes he runs unopposed.
Mm.
So I'll look into that.
Yeah, all right. Well,
because I'm going to vote for one of them because I'm pulling a Republican primary ballot, so you don't have to look it up.
Oh, good. You won't fall prey to the Richard. We won't have to do hit pieces
right.
on Amy Jacobson's voted in 7 of the last 8 Democrat primaries.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Enter. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Oh, yes, the pressure to do something. The pressure to get a bullet point for a mail piece or to insulate yourself from attacks. That pressure got to 15 Republicans who voted with the 50 socialists to give passage to the gun control bill that has been drafted in response to the Uvalde school shooting. One of them, and most of them not surprising, they're either of that ilk or they're on their way out. One was surprising. I think she may find that that turns out to be a bad vote for her. Joni Ernst in Iowa? Of course, McConnell and John Cornyn. John Cornyn may find out that would be a bad vote for him in Texas. Well, he was getting booed at the convention.
Right, yeah, that's what I was going to say. He was over the weekend. He was strongly booed at the convention. And he was trying to explain himself, and no one would be quiet to even listen. But the one part of the bill, I mean, real quick, is that, well, I'll let you do your thing, and then I'll chime in about the boyfriend loophole.
Yeah.
Okay.
What about
So they label it like a serious dating partner. So what does serious mean? Are you dating after 3 months? Are you seriously dating after, you know, everyone's got these thresholds. So there's no timeline of when you're considered a serious dating partner. Well, and you could have a vengeful girlfriend make your life H-E double hockey sticks.
Well, this is an important point, and it's one of the reasons this is such poor legislation, the so-called Safer Communities Act. There's a good piece in the Journal by Robert Leiter, who's a law professor at Scalia Law School, GMU, George Mason. And he makes that point. Relationships come in all forms, so the senators provide three criteria for consideration: the length of the relationship, the nature of the relationship, the frequency and type of interaction between the people involved in the relationship. This means that a continuing serious relationship, which is the phrase, will be some function of quantity of dates, length of time, and physical intimacy. But as Professor Leiter argues, those factors are vague. They don't provide fair notice, and they're susceptible to inconsistent application. Of course they are. And by the way, this is what you want the federal government and its administrative agencies. This is what you want them doing. Making assessments about the length of your relationship based on dating and physical intimacy and so on and so forth.
And somebody could think you're dating and the guy would be like, I'm not dating you.
We have to, this is how we do, we have to do something though. You know what? And this is how we've gotten to this place. Pass it, throw out some criteria, and we'll let ATF or whatever administrative agency fill in the blanks, fill in the details. And then we'll let ATF, in conjunction with federal prosecutors, and you know, in conjunction with federal prosecutors, federal law, we'll let them make those judgment calls. Professor Leiter goes on, by failing to define dating relationship adequately, Congress is effectively delegating the critical question of who falls within this ban. We don't know exactly to whom they're delegating it, but you have an idea. It's going to be law enforcement around guns, so ATF and federal prosecutors. And so they did something. They abdicated their responsibility as legislators. Congratulations. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 646-36DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Something else on the topic, too. Doing something. Directly responding to one incident. And making it the law of the land, making the response the law of the land. You know, extreme cases make bad law. The law expands the categories of those to whom it is unlawful to sell a gun or ammunition to include anyone convicted of a felony as a juvenile. The bill also changes the federal prohibition on selling firearms to those who have been involuntarily committed to a mental institution. It excludes involuntary commitments before the age of 18, but it strengthens the enforcement of the prohibition against those involuntarily committed between 16 and 18. 15, you're fine. 16, 17, or 18, you're not. As Professor Leiter writes, we should be cautious before we make it impossible for children to live normal adult lives. Children and teenagers lack maturity and impulse control, something that normally is pointed out by the left to argue for lesser sentences for violent crimes. If this becomes this bill becomes law, which it will, a 12-year-old who joyrides in a car may find that he's never allowed to purchase a gun or ammunition. Could be a felony conviction, depending on. And the other thing that you would think the left would point out, but again, you got to do something. All the things that I say I am, all the principles I say I hold, they're suspended now because we have to do something.
This
Republicans
that was,
and Democrats.
Would this, what they pass, would that have stopped the Buffalo shooter or the Uvalde, Texas shooter?
I don't know how. There was no involuntary commitment.
Right.
Right. Wouldn't have. But we're going to focus.
Their medical records are clean.
We're going to focus in on those ages. And then, you know, maybe if we pass pass laws that surround those ages, it will appear that we're focusing in on these young men who have issues. But the other point on this, the racial and socioeconomic disparities. It's just every single time. And yet both sides fall for it every single time. Not completely. The left goes all in and betrays its stated constituents, poor urban dwellers. And then Republicans, a handful of them, will always come over because they're afraid to be called names. They're afraid to be characterized as toadies for the NRA or indifferent to the death of children. But when it's time to run in a primary or run for the next office in a primary, they're out there with their rifle shooting in the commercials, and they're touting their NRA endorsement, and they're telling you they understand the Second Amendment is an individual right and they'll protect it, like Joni Ernst, and then they fold on this because you got to do something. Well, here's what you're doing. Wealthy communities, of course, they'll be fine. Their kids get in trouble? They get attorneys, like good ones, not public defenders.
Right, to expunge the record.
Or to get alternate diversion programs, alternate sentencing that avoids a felony conviction. A lot of times in the poorer communities, I don't know if you've been to 26th and Cal recently, you know, you have public defenders with big caseloads, and you just plead out, and you get the felony conviction. I mean, we've referenced this statistic before. The estimate is nearly one-third of adult black men in this country have a felony conviction. One-third. To borrow from Professor Leiter, George Mason, Scalia Law School, we should be cautious before we make it impossible for children to live normal adult lives. This is not to say that you are not held to account for crimes you commit. It's not to say that at all. But we should be cautious about making it impossible to live normal adult lives, because what do? You incentivize people who've committed crimes to make that their adult life.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line.
Same thing goes for the mental health side, these involuntary commitments. Wealthy parents don't have to involuntarily commit because they can afford to provide voluntary treatment. I'll get you this psychiatrist. Either if you don't agree to go to the psychiatrist, Junior, then this is the other option. Gun owners who've committed juvenile indiscretions will find they're no longer able to purchase firearms or ammunition. The bill also has strange technical defects. It prohibits the sale of guns and ammunition to those convicted of juvenile offenses, but it doesn't explicitly ban possession. You can't buy a gun. You can't buy ammo. but you're not banned from possessing a gun. What? Right. But you got to do something. You see. Randy in Crown Point.
Morning, guys. This bill plays right in the hands of the typical rhino and the typical George Soros-backed DAs. These George Soros-backed DAs, as we are seeing, are not going to charge any of these juveniles with felonies. They just don't. You can see what's going on. They're giving them the alternative plans, these schools, these different programs to get out of the felony. So it plays right into the hand. And the rhinos, this is the way these guys think, but in their districts, if they get elected, they know they can't stand up against the gun lobbies, against the gun money, and the people in their constituents. They can't stand up. So they have to toe the line. But when they're getting ready to leave, because you got to look at the numbers, when they're getting ready to leave the Senate permanently, then they vote for it. So it plays to both sides of that, the rhino and these progressive. This fits a progressive agenda, because what they're saying is guns are okay because these DAs are just going to let it go. That's just the way this bill is written.
Thanks for the call, Randy. Yeah, maybe in some places, but not every place, because not every place is lorded over by a Soros-funded DA. It's a big country. And there's a lot of people that live in the suburbs and exurbs and rural areas that where you have prosecutors actually enforce the law. Number one. But yes, he's right to say rhinos and socialists both like this, which is why you see rhinos and socialists voting for it. Why? Because it's a virtue signal. We did something. Make community safer? No. Probably.
Is the pain of the families who lost a loved one? No.
Will it do more?
It wouldn't have stopped either of those shooters.
Will it do more harm than good, net, in terms of the rule of law in a free society? Probably. But we did something. We did something. Everybody go to the bill signing. We did it in a bipartisan.
Everybody gets a pen.
We did it in a bipartisan fashion, and, you know, that's always a lovely way to do things. Collaboratively. Kathy Hochul, governor of New York, reacted to the Supreme Court holding in the concealed carry case. I want to get to that. Here's what she said.
As governor of the state of New York, my number one priority is to keep New Yorkers safe. But today, the Supreme Court is sending us backwards in our efforts to protect families and prevent gun violence. And it's particularly painful that this came down at this moment, when we're still dealing with families in pain from mass shootings that have occurred, the loss of life, their beloved children and grandchildren. Today, the Supreme Court struck down a New York law that limits who can carry concealed weapons. Does everyone understand what a concealed weapon means? That you have no forewarning, that someone can hide a weapon on them and go into our subways, go into our grocery stores like stores up in Buffalo, New York, where I'm from, go into a school in Parkland or Uvalde. This could place millions of New Yorkers in harm's way. And this is at a time when we're still mourning the loss of lives, as I just mentioned. This decision isn't just reckless, it's reprehensible. It's not what New Yorkers want. And we should have the right of determination of what we want to do in terms of our gun laws in our state.
Yeah, limited by the Constitution there, Gov. And but this is what you get. This is what you get. You get the opportunity for this phony moral indignation from hacks like Kathy Hochul.
But she got even a little more lippy.
Say we are not powerless in this situation. We're not going to cede our rights that easily, despite the best efforts of the politicized Supreme Court of the United States of America.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So,
you know how it works.
With the New York law, just so you understand, required, with certain exceptions, getting a permit to carry a handgun through the demonstration there was proper cause, which was interpreted to mean a special need beyond that of the general community or of persons engaged in the same profession. Yeah. Well, that's not
one example.
That's not the deal. And Thomas, Justice Thomas, who wrote the majority opinion, 6-3, pointed out the Heller and McDonald cases, recognizing that both the Second and 14th Amendment protect the right of an ordinary law-abiding citizen to possess a handgun in the home for self-defense. He then turned to the Bruin case, saying, in this case, petitions and respondents agree ordinary law-abiding citizens have a similar right to carry handguns publicly for their self-defense. Although we remarked in Heller that the need for armed defense is perhaps the most acute in the home, we did not suggest that the need was insignificant elsewhere. Many Americans hazard greater danger outside the home than in it, and the text of the amendment, Second Amendment, reflects that reality, the right to keep and bear arms. Yeah. Most gun owners do not wear a holstered pistol at their hip in their bedroom or while sitting at the dinner table. To combine the right to bear arms to the home would nullify half of the Second Amendment's operative protections, wrote Thomas. Right. Pretty straightforward. Unsurprising. We talked about this case when the Supreme Court granted it cert. We anticipated this outcome, and you can anticipate the response. Something interesting, though, from polling I recently did in Illinois. You think, oh, boy, I better support, you know, an assault weapon ban. And you see these socialists and these surrender Republicans voting for all sorts of previously, at least before these Supreme Court decisions, voting for these gun control measures. I mean, handgun bans all up the North Shore and in Chicago, of course, for so long.
25 years.
Ask the question, more or less likely to vote for someone who opposes an assault weapon ban. And, you know, that's a charged phrase. Everybody sort of knows what it means because it's bandied about by politicians for so long. More or less likely to support a candidate who opposes an assault weapon ban. Oh, yeah, that's where we got to give ground. The assault weapon ban, scary, suburban women. You know all the arguments. 50-50.
Really?
50-50. This is a dead bang winner for the gun banners, dead bang winner for the Democrats. You can't have an NRA member. You can't have somebody who owns a sport rifle, run as a Republican, and win statewide in Illinois. It's a 50-50 issue. Get a grip. Make an argument. Pat in Dyer, Indiana.
Good morning. I'd like to see the NRA make a bigger stand on those who voted for this today. I'd like to see a price to pay, so to speak. They should come out today and claim or refuse to do any more funding of these rhinos and give them an F in their ratings.
Absolutely. And,
let them struggle with their choices.
Yeah.
If you want to do away with stuff like this.
Thanks for the call, Pat. No, I agree. There's got to be consequences. And, you know, sometimes the NRA errs on the side of incumbents because they have records against challengers. But, yeah, sometimes incumbents have records, and they have records now like Joni Ernst in Iowa has. And we'll see if that, among other issues, precipitates a challenge. It's definitely going to precipitate some concern. Jordan in Antioch.
Morning, Dan. Morning, Amy. One of the things that really concerned me through this whole thing, and now it's gone, now it's passed and it's going in the House, was you didn't hear anything about the repercussions of the bad side of the red flag laws. And there's a gentleman in Maryland, I'd have to look it up exactly verbatim, but there's a gentleman in Maryland whose sister-in-law didn't like him. They had a disagreement, and she called in and called in on red flag law on him. He was shot to death by the police on a no-knock warrant to seize his weapons based on a non-due process red flag law.
Yeah.
You don't hear anything about that, and that really concerned me that you didn't, and I don't think you're going to hear about that until they try to primary these guys. But the other thing that this does is, you know, I don't think they realize how many of these people that potentially were a problem or might show that they were a problem, you just pushed underground, and they're never going to surface, they're never going to show themselves. And the governor from New York references Parkland, and it makes me want to vomit when they do that, because how many instances did they have where the police were at that kid's house and the FBI knew it, and they didn't do anything about it? And here's one you're going to go after people that you get a phone call over somebody that may or may not be valid, but yet you have validated, recorded visits to this guy's house, and you know he's a threat, and you did nothing.
Yeah.
It's really sad.
Thanks for the call, Jordan. Thanks for the call, Jordan. Yeah, right, but Jordan, we did something. We did something. Celebrate us. Linda, Lowell, Indiana.
Yeah, I just wanted to tell you two examples of how people acquiesce to the government. I'm in the middle of COVID. I'm in a hardware store without a mask, and a guy passes me by in his 40s, and he says, "Can I not wear a mask?" I shrugged my shoulders, and I said, "Yeah," and he took his mask off. I had the power at that point. I work at a little convenience store. A lady comes in buying menthol cigarettes. I said, "You know, the government's trying to ban these," and she goes, "Well, I hope they do. I have to quit."
It's always nice to run into one of the Bouvier sisters. Thanks for the call, Linda.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560 The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We were talking about the Supreme Court holding in the Bruin case and validating the concealed carry law in New York State, finding it was a unconstitutional infringement on the Second Amendment rights of New York State residents. A fascinating feature of this case is the legal representation provided to the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association, the plaintiff. They were represented by two attorneys from Kirkland and Ellis. You know, big white shoe law firm. Paul Clement and Aaron Murphy are their names. And they're leaving Kirkland and Ellis because they refused the partner's demand that they drop the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association as a client. We are blessed to have represented before the Supreme Court a wide variety of clients, from large corporations and religious orders to criminal defendants and Native American groups. After we prevail before the high court, we generally receive a round of congratulatory messages from law firm colleagues for a job well done, especially when we've helped our clients vindicate their fundamental constitutional rights. This time around, very different message. Having just secured a landmark decision vindicating our clients' constitutional Second Amendment rights in New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin, we were presented with a stark choice: withdraw from representing them or withdraw from the firm. They made their choice, saying we couldn't abandon our clients simply because their positions are unpopular in some circles. A lawyer can withdraw from a representation for a good reason, likely a newly discovered conflict of interest, but defending unpopular clients is what we do. Right? The universally popular require less representation. This is, you know, sort of the corollary to free speech. Yeah, it's the unpopular speech that we're talking about, because the popular speech isn't in controversy.
So do they have to dump all their Second Amendment clients now going forward if people want to stay there?
Well, these lawyers aren't going forward.
Oh, well, yeah, they're not. But in the future...
Well, the ironic thing, this isn't the first time we have left a firm to stick by a client. What makes this circumstance different is that the firm approved our representation of these clients years ago. You know, it takes a while to get to the Supreme Court. And dropping them would cost the clients years of institutional memory. More remarkable still, in one of those cases we were asked to drop, we won. Those who object to the representation are thus taking issue with the Constitution as interpreted by a majority of the high court. But what has happened to Kirkland and Ellis is what's happening in corporate America writ large. I mean, this probably doesn't come as a surprise to people who are Second Amendment enthusiasts, because, you know, you follow these news, you follow the news, you know the stories of gun dealers or gun stores who have had their bank accounts frozen, or banks have told them, not interested in doing business with you anymore. Why? What did I do? You're in the gun industry. You're a bad guy. So now it's made its way to Kirkland and Ellis, big law firms. What a position for Kirkland and Ellis to take. And it's funny because I know lawyers there.
Have you talked to them about this yet?
And Kirkland Ellis's reputation is to represent, well, exactly what Paul Clement and Aaron Murphy wrote about. We've represented religious orders, corporations, criminal defendants, Native American groups, so on and so forth. You know, you build your reputation in part by representing clients who have a compelling matter of constitutional importance at bar in their case or their claim. And now they're saying, well, unless it's the Second Amendment. The partners at Kirkland and Ellis, unless it's the Second Amendment. Then, hey.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Were you surprised by this?
Surprised that they were asked to drop the client or leave the firm?
Yeah.
A little bit. I mean, you know, and by the way,
disconcerting.
By the way, you know, you're not at Kirkland and Ellis unless you're a talented attorney.
Got to be good at your job.
Paul Clement, one of the two attorneys in the case who's taking a walk, he's a former U.S. Solicitor General. I mean, this isn't like, you know, somebody fresh out of law school here. Erin Murphy, she is an appellate lawyer. They're both partners at Kirkland and Ellis. These are good lawyers, clearly. And nope, the window or the stairs. You either throw your clients out the window or you're taking the stairs. So they took the stairs. Good for them. I mean, I'm not worried about them getting jobs elsewhere because they're good attorneys and they've been making a lot of money if they're partners at Kirkland and Ellis. But it's nice to see that the status of being a partner at Kirkland and Ellis and the money that comes along with it is not more important to Paul Clement and Aaron Murphy than the canons. So for all the grief that lawyers take, most of it deserved, there are these cases like this one where you are encouraged by some in the legal profession that they take their ethical responsibility seriously. They take the Constitution seriously, and they take our justice system seriously. The adversarial nature of our justice system and litigating for clients' rights, in addition to just making, you know, the big fees representing big corporations and commercial litigation.
It's just where normally you celebrate victorious lawyers. Are they? Hopefully, they'll take their clients with them when they join a new law firm.
Well, I mean, I just wanted...
Hopefully somebody's reached out to them.
It's worth bringing attention to this matter because it's not limited to Kirkland and Ellis. It's not limited to the legal profession. That's why I said this is a story about corporate America and 2022 America.
It's our new lives. It's our new world, which is sad.
And hopefully we'll have more Paul Clements and Aaron Murphys out there. Hopefully their ethical stand here will inspire others to do similarly. John in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Thanks for taking my call. You know, I think that there should be an investigation to see if anybody from the administration or DOJ reached out to Kirkland and Ellis to cause this to happen. And there needs to be hearings. There needs to be a special prosecutor, because if so, that is a grave, grave injustice that needs to be punished.
Thanks for the call, John.
Do you think they're that stupid that they do that?
You know who was a partner of Kirkland and Ellis?
Oh, who? Dan Webb? No.
No. Winston. Partner Kirkland Ellis? A one former attorney general named Robert Barr.
Oh. I don't think he would.
I'm not implicating him. I'm suggesting that, you know, I suspect that there is divide within the vast expanse of the partners at Kirkland and Ellis. I'm sure there is.
Yeah.
Sure, there's political divide here. Pretty embarrassing, because this is more than what your view is on the Second Amendment. This is what your view is of your profession, of your job. This is how much importance you place on ethical considerations. That's the debate I expect that more enlightened partners at Kirkland Ellis would be pushing inside the firm. I would if I were there. George and Moni.
Hey, Dan, 2 points. One, if you're going to play stories with lots of incest in it, you really should have banjo music behind it. But second, isn't the American Bar Association supposed to be policing unscrupulous lawyers and law firms, you know, that pull this kind of crap?
Well, no. I mean, the ARDC polices ethical breaches, but... So, I mean, I guess Paul Clement and Aaron Murphy could cook up some sort of ARDC complaint against the partners at Kirkland and Ellis. But, you know, I know that's not productive and it's not going anywhere. I think the bigger hit for them is this becoming public. I don't think it presents Kirkland and Ellis in a particularly good light. No. And it will have reverberations through the legal community, and it will generate debate, and that's a good thing.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word APP to 64636 to download the app today.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer.
Morning, Dan and Amy. Federal Reserve sorcerer Jay Powell was before the House yesterday, second day of testimony on the Hill. And just looking back on the good old days when inflation was transitory until it became something less transitory. Jay Powell reflected on that and gave his sort of version of the last year of Fed policymaking.
Just giving us hindsight, inflation was coming down month by month. If you look at monthly readings for CPI or PCE, they were coming down month on month on month through September. And so that I think, told us that our thesis that this was going to be a passing inflation shock was at least plausible. I think that the data turned pretty hard in October and November, and we very much changed our position. And since then, have tightened financial conditions quite significantly. So it was a matter of a few months when we were really looking at this and thinking it's going to be passing. Most macroeconomists thought that it would be a passing thing. It turned out to not have been so far. Well, we did underestimate it. With the benefit of hindsight, clearly we did. So it comes down to this judgment that we had to make. It has really nothing to do with our framework or anything like that. Every central bank had to make the same judgment, which was looking at the supply chain problems and, you know, the shock to labor force participation, millions of people out of the labor force. We had to decide whether that was going to be a lasting thing or whether it would kind of turn around quickly. You know, we had very high levels of labor force participation. Suddenly they're much lower. The thought was people will come back. As soon as COVID is over, we have these new vaccines. Every American is going to get vaccinated. We'll be done with COVID by the end of the year. So basically, these supply side issues, broadly speaking, just didn't get better. There were recurring waves, and that was the judgment we had to make. We knew it could be wrong, and I think when it started to look pretty wrong, we pivoted.
Framework wasn't wrong. It was just a timing thing. Just we saw it going this way. These were the judgments that we and other academics made. And, again, we're a little bit off. Turned out to be not so much of a passing fancy, really. Is there anything that happened that may suggest to you real inflationary pressure on the economy? For example, $10 trillion of funny money in 24 months. Do you think that would implicate the possibility, the likelihood, the metaphysical certainty that you're going to see inflation. Because what I think is actually true, and this didn't come out from what I saw with Jay Powell, given that, you know, I'm just sort of a mechanic, and we're just, you know, we're just working on the parts that need fixing on a daily basis. No, actually, your framework is wrong, Jay, because your framework and the framework of the other central bankers, which is why the Western world is in varying degrees of the same predicament, is modern monetary theory. You think you can print money without consequence. And it turns out that all you academics and central bankers need to go back and review your Econ 101 textbook, because that's how this actually played out. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Carol Roth, former investment banker. She's an entrepreneur, author of The War on Small Business, How the Government Used the Pandemic to Crush the Backbone of America. Hey, Carol, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning, guys. You know, I am, for one, shocked that when you play with matches and have a lot of dry hay sitting around, that the house burns down. The framework for that is that you could just light everything on fire and, you know, it would be a pretty blaze. But, you know, that would be the only consequence. I can't believe that that was the way it turned out.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the thing that's so unnerving about listening to Jay Powell talk. And frankly, most of the members of Congress are not much better, which is why you don't get sort of these moments. But that really does need to be pressed, is that the policy choices that were made that brought us to this point, it was inevitable that we were going to be here in some form or fashion at some point in the not too distant future. And we're here.
Yeah, I mean, just listening to him makes me want to pull my usually very large hair out, because, you know, many of us, I mean, I had this conversation with you guys how many times over the past, you know, year and a half or so, and it was the inevitable consequence. And so, you know, not only did you have this enormous money printing and you had stuff that was called stimulus, and then they're going to say, you know, I'm really surprised something that was called stimulus overstimulated the economy. We could never predict something that was in the word actually did what the word said. And then this idea that they didn't have any idea about these supply constraints and that they were going to change, you know, turn around, exacerbated by policy. I mean, we know who left the workforce and why. We know that we had 3 million people who retired early, in large part because their 401ks were going up and because their houses values were going up. We know that we had 2 million legal immigrants who weren't able to, you know, come into the country as projected because of the border closing. I mean, we knew all of these kinds of things. We knew on the housing front that we're underbuilt by 4 to 5 million homes. We know that we have an underinvestment in energy and commodities and the like. So these are the people who are paid to know this. They are making multi-trillion dollar decisions with the economy. So if they don't know something that's like so completely obvious, like neon red sign obvious, then what are they doing? And how do we have that power vested in people who can't make the most obvious, you know, calls and decisions?
And Carol, I love your tweet. You know who would see inflation coming? Corn Pop. It's really good.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Amy, Corn Pop was a bad dude, but you know, he did take Econ 101. So, like, literally, anybody could have seen inflation coming. I mean, Helen Keller could have seen inflation coming. I mean,
All right. No, so, Helen, don't do Helen Keller jokes.
No,
we can't do Helen Keller jokes.
Oh, you can't do that.
No.
Apologies to the power of the P. Okay.
How far into the recession?
Why is Helen Keller such a bad driver?
Oh, boy.
Oh, no.
Don't answer it. I don't. Why, Dan?
Because she's a woman.
Oh.
See, not a blind joke.
See, but you had us going.
Yeah, all right.
All right, so how far into the recession are we going to be before they admit we're in a recession? 6 months 9 months, you know?
Yeah, this is a question. I've been actually saying this for the past couple of weeks. You know, the NBER, which is the group that calls recessions, has now made a non-definition of it. So it's now, we used to say, oh, it was, you know, 2/4 of GDP contraction. Now it's this sort of like flowery language about, you know, several months. And, you know, we look at the depth and we look at the duration and different factors. And so, you know, there's lots of weasel words there where they may say, well, you know, technically it wasn't because this, that, and the other thing, kind of like they do with everything else. So I think it's going to be incumbent upon the rest of us to decide, you know, whether or not it's a recession. And, you know, I would go back to the traditional definition, but they manipulate the numbers. I mean, we could, given the fact that we had the first quarter that was, you know, contracted, we could be in a recession right now. And if you look at the math of the components of GDP, it's really, you know, we know that government spending will be down year over year just because there, you know, isn't the stimulus component, not that, you know, they're being fiscally responsible or anything. We have a very strong dollar vis-a-vis other currencies, not, you know, on its own, but vis-a-vis what's going on with other currencies around the world. So that's not going to help us on the net export side. So it comes down to business investment and the consumer. Businesses are getting hammered in the market, and on a real inflation-adjusted basis, consumers are obviously getting hammered by gas and other inflation. So do we think that businesses and the consumer over the last quarter are going to be able to make up for that deficit, you know, from, you know, what the government, you know, didn't spend year over year? Math-wise, you know, that's a pretty tall order, especially when the Fed's trying to cool down the economy, but it's possible we could eke out something.
You know, I'm getting a little bit confused again, because I think we need, and we're talking about more supply, more energy supply, right? I think that's why Biden is going to Saudi Arabia and he's put a call into Maduro over in Venezuela and so on and so forth. And that, but then I see the Democrats, socialists on the Hill, are proposing a late 1970s style windfall profit tax on oil and gas companies. There's a good thread by Nirupama Rao, who is a professor at the University of Michigan Business School. It turns out she did her thesis some dissertation on the windfall profits tax of the Carter era, I should say. And the bottom line, what she finds is that a windfall profit tax would reduce domestic production in real time. That the result from history is that this is the response from the industry and it reduces domestic production. And at the same time, we're hearing the big guy and his flax talk about how we need more oil refined. We need more oil to market. But then his party is also talking about a windfall profits tax.
Yeah, this is one of the things I'm most mad at the Biden administration about, is the fact that I have to go, you know, on programs like yours and defend big oil.
Yeah, exactly.
that wasn't the stance I wanted to take, but yet here we are. I mean, we had a situation during the pandemic. The top five, you know, big oil producers lost $76 billion. So, you know, anything that they're making now is sort of normalizing it. They were producing gas. They were, you know, having gas available while we needed it during the pandemic. We want them to be here for us. The issue, the reason why we don't have as much oil production as we did before COVID, you know, part of it is because of the underinvestment. And that underinvestment is being driven by the left. It's being driven by ESG. It's being driven by Biden campaigning on, we are going to shut you down. We are going to stop the drilling. We're going to stop this. And as the oil company executives are going to say, you know, we're not making multi-billion dollar long-term investments when you want to shut us down and because you need to be bailed out politically. You know, this has to actually make sense. So price controls, you know, just like any other, you know, central planning idiocy, as going back to your professor's dissertation there, that is the outcome that they have, because why would you put up that investment if you knew that you were being handicapped? It doesn't make sense. It's the opposite of everything that we've learned in the free market. And of course, it is going to further constrict supply. And it kind of goes back to all of this idiocy coming from the government, coming from the Fed. They are just so decoupled from reality, or they're intentionally trying to destroy us.
Yeah,
those are the only two options that we have here.
On the intentional side of it, though, you know, a debtor loves inflation, right?
I mean, they certainly do. It's that the only way that they can print their way out of it. That the ridiculous, you know, as you said, MMT, modern monetary theory. I call it magic money tree. That hey, well, you know, we own the printing process, so we can never default. You know, we can just print our way out of inflation, which again is technically true, but you can't do it without destroying the value of the dollar and ultimately the economy. So they do love it.
You know, you're gonna break a few eggs.
It's true.
Carol Roth, former investment banker, entrepreneur, and author of The War on Small Business, How the Government Used the Pandemic to Crush the Backbone of America. Carol, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Have a great weekend, guys.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, since we're going to talk about last night's AM 560 Illinois Republican primary, Republican governor primary debate, this is a tutorial on how you handle the media. For all you Republican candidates out there, you know the media is antagonistic. In D.C., it's antagonistic to the federally elected Republicans out there in Chicago, to all Illinois Republicans who are not complicit with Democrats. Carrie Lake is a Republican candidate for governor.
Yeah, but before that, she worked at Fox 10 in Phoenix for years as the main anchor there. People who live in that area are very well familiar with her.
Okay, well,
Yeah.
So she's a Republican candidate for governor in Arizona. She needs to know something a little bit about the media, about her industry, her former industry. She was approached by a CNN reporter, and that's how this went.
Hi.
Hi.
Nice to see you. CNN.
You don't have a mask on anymore. What's going on?
We're outside. Do you have a minute to chat?
Well, we're 6 feet apart.
Do you have a minute to chat?
I'll do an interview.
Okay.
As long as it airs on CNN Plus.
Oh.
Does that still exist? Yeah. I didn't think so, because the people don't like what you guys are peddling, which is propaganda. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Wow. And that wasn't just her. That was Kyung Lau, who used to work here at Channel 2, and now she's at CNN.
Who cares?
Who cares?
CNN Plus. That's great. Sure. It has to be on CNN Plus. Can you
resurrect it so I can do the interview?
Can it be a package on Chris Wallace's show on CNN Plus? Oh, wait, right. Yeah, take a hike.
My favorite is
perfect.
Where's your mask? Where's your mask?
You're not wearing a mask.
Oh, I mean.
Perfect.
Because they know. Perfect.
Good for Carrie Lake. I like her. I mean, I don't know that much about her, but I certainly like her after that performance.
A lot of.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560 The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Need to talk about last night's final Republican gubernatorial debate hosted by AM 560. Ably moderated by Mike Scott, with contributions from Ms. Jacobson and Greg Bishop from Center Square. But before that, you mentioned Gary Rabine went missing there during the break. There was one break.
Yeah, he had to go to the bathroom.
And you said he took out his microphone, but it turns out he didn't. While you were talking, while you were fluffing the crowd,
yeah,
as
right.
it were. Yeah.
Our sixth visit. Indeed. It is for all the people who will be able to share in the celebration, especially excited, will be the Queen's public appearances.
Queen.
It's a long...
You have to go.
Uh-oh. It's making me have to go.
Wait for it.
We also would like to...
Wow.
Whoops. Uh-oh.
You are not going to be invited back. You are... Ball Valley will be off limits for 2 years, man. You're off limits.
You got to explain why it took so long for him to come back from his bathroom break. That's all in good fun.
And we started to. He comes back. In.
Yeah, no.
But it was great.
He had to go. That's all.
Yeah, he had to go.
Yeah, it's no problem.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. What did you think of last night's debate? The big winner, the big losers. I know a lot of undecided voters were there. And,
sure, they turned out. I could tell from the applause that they turned out en masse to see you live and in person. You took the occasion of one of the questions that you asked to slander me, to defame my good name.
Wow. Okay, you know, here it is.
All right, the GOP state legislators, some of them have jumped ship from Richard Ervin. And I know that some are now supporting you, Jesse Sullivan, Ryan Spain being one of them out of Peoria. My co-host, Dan Prof, said that they're supporting you, quote, because they can control you and keep their little thiefdoms. What is your response?
Oh. Yeah. So that's not what I said. Okay. I mean, his response was fine, and I'm kidding, of course. But my point about the rats jumping off the sinking Ervin ship and going to Sullivan, like Ryan Spain and Peoria. It's not even about Sullivan. It's about them. They think that this is their way to have an in. They think that this is a place they might be able to have a play. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. I don't know enough about Jesse Sullivan, frankly. I don't have enough of a feel for Jesse Sullivan, which is part of his problem, to say one way or the other.
Well, here's Jesse.
But I mean, understand my it wasn't a commentary on Sullivan. It was a commentary on those rats.
I bend my knee to God alone and nobody else. I owe nobody anything in this corrupt insider system we have in Illinois. Not only the Democrat side, this insider corrupt pay-to-play politics that exists on the Republican side. And I am going to take it on. Every bit of this corruption, I am going to take on. And you know, the reason why they've jumped in to support me is because they have two eyes to see and two ears to hear.
Yeah. I know he's a newbie, but fresh out of the gate for all the tough talk last night, he was unwilling on this show to name names when he made the claim that somebody came to him and tried to threaten him out of the race, tried to buy him out of the race.
Or said, wait, you know, the Senate seat's going to be coming up soon. Why don't you, cool your heels?
Trying to buy him out. Yeah, we'll come up with this money if you run for Senate, or we'll ruin you if you don't. I think it was a combination of the two, was alleged. And I'm sure it happened. I don't doubt the veracity. But, you know, yeah, I don't want to name names. Well, you know what? You don't want to name names. You don't want to take these fights on publicly and identify who the bad actors are the way that I do. Frankly, in my opinion, who the bad actors are, and I present the evidentiary case, and you can make up your own minds, then, that's why I say about Jesse Sullivan, and the reason he's not going to be the nominee is, he's a nice family. I think people have a hard time getting a handle on who this guy is, and you have to have a handle on who somebody is if you're going to support them. I think that's where you separate winning candidates from those candidates who are less successful. I mean, well, resources being equal. And I think Sullivan still comes across as sort of unidimensional.
Well, one thing that was, who's lying? Because Darren Bailey, did you or did you not raise taxes 14 times?
Especially Darren, who's raised property taxes 14 times. People might consider, if he raises it a 15th time.
It's going to be an interesting evening.
It might be on the people of Illinois. Well, Darren, I think really, who needs an answer are the people of Illinois right now, because we are sick and tired of paying these high taxes.
And he said he didn't. And then Gary Rabine chimed in. He's like, yes, you did. And so what's the answer?
Mark in Plainfield, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. The obvious loser is Ervin for not showing up. I thought Bailey blew it at the end when they were asking about the energy, and he gave a nod to green energy, even though it is in the future. Green energy is not going to work. It shouldn't even be discussed now. I think Sean and Elwood Park boy Gary Raybine won the debate. He gave the best answer on the energy question, and he was giving good answers all night long.
Mm. Yeah, he was on fire. He was very, very good.
We got 400,000 businesses under my wings in an organization I helped found, okay? So I can bring business back here like nobody else. But when I talk about that taxpayer pledge, all right, your Silicon, Jesse, I got to say, I'm gonna say your Silicon Sully, okay? Silicon Sully. You come from Silicon Valley. It's a different world than Illinois. That pledge is not worth a darn here.
What are you saying? He lived there 2 years. To Stanford. I know the whole, you know, where'd you get your money from? But people were, you know, concerned about that. And then some people were concerned about, you know, Darren Bailey saying that he would allow local control of school districts. And here's his response to that.
Thank you. Exactly. And I clarified that at the end, and it was actually in the end of the article, and I wish they would have read farther. Here's the deal.
It wasn't in the video because we cut it out of the video.
You can watch the
video. It wasn't in the
critical
video, just so you know.
Critical race theory is un-American, period. It does not belong in our schools. I think we need to heed the advice of Martin Luther King, and we need to start working towards becoming a colorblind society. Critical race theory teaches our children to look at race and race only. Friends, I have said from day one, I'm the only one that stood up on the Senate floor and argued against this again in the wee hours of the morning. Critical race theory was written into the rules. Critical race theory will be, with a new Illinois State Board of Education, be written out of the rules. And the part that I clarified is that I will empower parents to be heard from their school boards, and we will make sure that school boards hear from their parents. Local control and people working together, that's how we do this. If we relegate government to do everything, then we're going to have the same problems that we have now. Yeah, that's in the back of the article. And then finally, if that
doesn't
work,
I
will be there to do whatever it takes to take care of this nonsense, because it is egregious that the Skokie School Board has said that they're going to do this. Where is the outrage in that? Where are the parents at standing up?
Are you going to give them local control, school districts local control?
Yeah.
You asked the Trump question?
Yes.
So that was the you know, why should Trump endorse you? Because he's coming to town on Quincy to endorse Mary Miller in her race against Rodney Davis for that congressional seat downstate. And Trump said yesterday in a radio interview about Pritzker and about who would be best to face him, quoting Trump here. Well, it would look like Bailey. I haven't made an endorsement, but he's doing a good job. A lot of people are liking him, and I think that, you know, he would potentially have a shot. Pritzker has been a terrible, terrible governor. He's done such a bad job, and with the lockdowns and with everything else that you would know better than anybody, but I think maybe Bailey would be the one. I don't know how the polls are, but he seems to be formidable, and he could give it a good shot because, you know, it's a little bit hard to win up there for a Republican in that way. So let's see what happens, but I think Bailey may be the typical sort of Trump process of
indicating there's still a chance
where he's going, but not, you know, but teasing you along the way. And so the polling, which Trump has seen, has Bailey up 22 points over Sullivan, with Irvin actually in third, 25 points down.
And I think that's going to slip even lower, too, don't you?
Could. And if you look.
Throw away vote.
And I tweeted the regional and the geo and the demo breakouts. I mean, men, women, every region of the state, Bailey is in the lead. So it's going to take something of a deus maxima, I think, to change the outcome on Tuesday. But, you know, that's why we have elections. We'll see. Greg in LaGrange, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, good morning. As far as the debate last night, I'm glad I caught it. I thought Gary Raybine did very well. I thought Darren Bailey got beat up unnecessarily about the local school board issue. Listen, if you don't control what happens at your local level, all the way down to the library system, you're going to get screwed. So it's up on the people in their area to take care of that kind of those kind of local issues. That's why they're local issues, and that's why they're important. Gary Raybine, I think, oversimplified the issue of bringing businesses back to Illinois.
We all know that there are so many problems here. I think that we need to not sugarcoat just using a generic saying that I've been in business and I brought businesses back and I can do it again. We're facing a whole bunch of new problems by these socialists, and we need to start knocking them down one by one. It's a lot harder problem than what it appears, and I think we need to not sugarcoat it. Thank you, guys. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Greg. Appreciate it. Oh, of course, we got to hear from the entire Jacobson family.
Well, at least she's involved. This is good.
Where does Chrissy live?
Arlington Heights.
Chrissy in Arlington Heights, who may or may not be related to Amy here on Chicago's Morning Answer.
I may or may not be related.
Shh, don't tell anybody.
She even talks like you two talk the same.
We're 14 months apart. Yeah.
So I went last night kind of undecided, but leaning towards Bailey. At the end, I'm voting for Jesse. I didn't like the whole, like, this arrogance that Bailey had last night. I'm better than all of you. Laughing, and I don't know. It just rubbed me the wrong way, so.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Well, all right. Fair enough.
Thanks for calling in.
Yeah.
Thanks for being nice, Dan. Not attacking her.
Well, I thought, did she actually ask the questions last night, or was it you? Is she, did you guys do that? Where, like, Chrissy would show up to an Amy thing and Amy would show up to a Chrissy thing? Did you?
No.
She never stood in for you in one of your proms?
No.
Oh. All right. I'm just checking. Anything else you'd like to cover in the debate?
There's a Paul Shimp. I mean.
No.
No.
Okay. I mean,
he is a nice guy. He's a wonderful human being.
It's wonderful. And I appreciate her service to our country and the Marines. But, you know, I got to tell you. This whole routine he does, and you see this every cycle from one candidate or another, where it's like, you know, we can't attack other Republicans. We're just helping J.B. Pritzker. I'm so honored and thank you so much. And so just stop. Okay, these things are supposed to be street fights, and debates are supposed to be rough and tumble like they were last night, which is why last night's was by far the best debate. Of the cycle, because you're supposed to let people interact. We're adults, and you're trying, and people are trying to separate fact from fiction, listen to explanations in response to charges, listens to arguments being made for a particular policy idea, and just hash it out and say, you know, you took a vote and that was a bad vote. You took this money and that means you're beholden. You won't support this issue and that means you're disqualified. Hey, though, that's the nature of it. That's not attacking anybody. Is that violating Ronald Reagan's 11th commandment? It's a bunch of nonsense. And when you have somebody play that game with you the way that Schimpf does consistently, he's shining you on. I don't like it.
And Darren Bailey, you know, confronted Gary Rabine, hey, you wrote a $1,000 check to Rahm Emanuel. And Gary's like, yeah, I did. So I did.
Well, I know. Well, that's an example, but it's fine, fine to bring it up. I don't think Gary Rabine is beholden to Rahm Emanuel.
He's not.
I don't think it was pay to play. I also don't think he should have written Rahm Emanuel a check. What kind of judgment is that? You should. There is no circumstance, zero, under which you should be supporting Rahm Emanuel with a dime. It's not about the money, and it's not because it's pay-to-play, and it's not because I think Gary got anything for it. It's just bad judgment. I didn't like it when Rahner was writing checks for all those Democrats before he decided he was going to be a Republican candidate for governor either. So there's
Trump
some consistency here. Yeah, I know. I don't like it. We talked about when Trump was a candidate. I don't like it. It was one of the reasons I had suspicions about him. I don't like it. I don't see the sense in underwriting your enemies. That doesn't make any sense to me. Underwriting your enemies, political enemies. That's what you're doing. That makes no sense. It's bad judgment. Is it disqualifying? No. Is it evidence of some corruption? No. It's evidence of bad political judgment. So that's it. And that's the way it should be played. And that's what Bailey should have said in response to it. He didn't get anything for $1,000. It doesn't. Yeah. Right. He didn't get anything for it. He's not a pay-to-play guy. But that's bad political judgment. That's somebody who doesn't. He either doesn't get it or hasn't thought it through. Judy in Frankfurt.
Hey, Judy.
Hi. I was just calling about Sullivan. I
think that he overused the word God and used God in his whole format. And I believe in God. I love God, but I don't use God. And it just turned me off.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for the call, Judy. Art and Skokie.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. And it was a fine event yesterday. And looks like Rabbi, and he really cares about people, from what I understand. Mm-hmm. Looks like, at least he came across like he cared. And I want to ask you if Stephanie Trussell called Trump a piece of human poo, did she apologize for it, for saying it?
Yeah, Trussell's walked back in her comments on Trump, as I understand it. So, yeah, you know.
That's a good way. Randy from Crown Point's back. Art from Skokie's
back.
Thanks
for the call, Art. Appreciate it. You know, I mean, you had that. J.D. Vance had to walk in comments he made about Trump before Trump endorsed him for USN in Ohio. So, yeah, you know, I made comments about Trump that I will not walk back in, but they were not complimentary when he was first announced as a candidate. And so I won't walk him back. I will say about aspects about Trump I was wrong. But in terms of the concerns I had about him, in terms of what his past behavior was that could be indicative of future behavior, I won't walk him back. But the name calling and this and that. Yeah. You say, you know what? I thought he was going to be this guy, which is where I'm at. I thought he was going to be this guy as a candidate. And then as a president, I didn't always like him as a candidate. I didn't always like him rhetorically as a president. But he did a great job, and not just on the policy front, but on taking the fight to the left and having the left help by exposing who they actually are. And for that, I'm forever grateful whether he runs for president again or not. So that's what you can say. You know, the name calling and this and that, it's part of politics. I don't get hung up on it so much. I've been called plenty of names. You know, you got to get over it. And Trump did. Has multiple times with many candidates, as he mentioned in one of the rallies at J.D. Vance, explaining how could you endorse J.D. Vance after the things he said about you as a candidate for president. Said, and Trump, you know, in a rare moment of self-deprecation, frankly, you know, if I didn't endorse anybody who ever said anything bad about me, I couldn't endorse anybody.
Yeah.
It's just a perfect line and the perfect attitude. And that's why he still has great currency in the Republican primary and in the country. Jerry Nelson.
Yeah, so I was about the debate last night. I thought, you know, everyone did pretty good. Gary Rabine was a little abrasive, I thought, which kind of went out of character. He was usually that nice guy. But then back to local control with Darren Bailey, I think he, he ate dung on that topic. And then when he talked about Jesse Sullivan being a global businessman and he set up a business in Illinois, I believe he hired migrants that he forced to wear masks at that farm of his.
Yeah, Jerry,
well, that was
for
a federal
call.
I mean, that was out of his control.
Yeah, farmers hiring migrant workers. Wow. That's a real expose you got there. And yes, it's part of a federal program. And yes, you have to comply with federal mandates when you access federal programs, as farmers are wont to do, Jerry. And local control, Bailey's point, you want everything to be run through the state? I remember a time when conservatives believed in subsidiarity. We should remember that.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, in our continuing effort right up until Tuesday's primary election to bring you the candidates for important offices. Today we have two Republican candidates, one the incumbent, one the challenger, running for Kane County Clerk. Kane County Clerk, you ask?
What's that?
Well,
it's in Kane County. It's the clerk's office.
Yeah, but that's exactly right. But I thought that, you know, you don't have a lot of competitive primaries where issues of election integrity are central part of the campaign, but they're not central in the way that, like, they're running for an office whose responsibility is to ensure the proper administration of elections. Well, the clerk's office at the local level is such an agency, and with a competitive primary where there are apparently disagreements about the administration of elections in Kane County. I thought this would perhaps be illustrative of the larger topic of ballot security and ensuring free and fair elections in Chicagoland and the state of Illinois. Two candidates, John Cunningham is the incumbent. He's being challenged by an attorney named Doug Warlick. Yeah, I think you've probably heard his commercials on our airwaves.
Yes.
And it is Doug Warlick who joins us now. Doug, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, and thank you for having me. Actually, I'm not surprised that Mr. Cunningham isn't on right now because, as you know, I was going to follow his remarks this morning, and he hadn't shown up for any debate, so I would have been unable to debate him, so this is not surprising either.
Well, he did, just a point of order, he did agree to come on the show. We're having trouble getting him right now, but if we do, then he will follow you. But anyway, continue.
Sure. I didn't know if you wanted to ask me questions or if you just want me to make a statement.
Well, I mean, yeah, so, you're an attorney. Your impetus to change, I mean, I know Cunningham has been the clerk in Kane County for some time. Why launch this challenge?
You know, he's been the clerk for 20 years. And, in fact, 4 years ago, I approached Jack in his office and asked him what his intentions were, and he said that was his last term. And, of course, now he's doing it again. And, you know, I don't have any issues with folks in their mid-80s, but I think that you have a responsibility to the electorate, to the voters of Kane County, to go to work and to do your job. I mean, it would be kind of like, Biden saying, hey, it's not my fault. It's the fault of my handlers. And, I was at a meeting not long ago, and his friend of 60 years, I don't know if I should tell you this or not, but, truth is a defense. So Dick Johansson says, hey, it's not Jack's fault that the Kane County board went blue. It's Brian Pollock's fault. And you just find that interesting that they want to deflect. In my opinion, Jack wouldn't recognize a fair, free, and honest election if it hit him like a ton of bricks in the head. I mean, you go
first of all, because there's a lot there already. First, you said you have to show up for your job. Are you saying that Cunningham doesn't show up to work? He's not doing his job? What's the specific there?
Clearly not doing his job and letting other folks do it. I don't have the time records, and I'm not going to step outside the bounds of anything that I can't prove. So the things that I say are truthful. They're things that come from FOIA requests and from interviews or from direct knowledge or some things that I've observed myself. I'll leave that. The quote I just gave you is a quote from his purported best friend. So that's his best friend saying that he's not doing his job, and which you find interesting.
Well, that's his best friend saying that it's not Jack's fault that Kane County board went blue. I mean, it's not his public sector job to get Republicans elected to the Kane County board.
Agreed.
Absolutely
agreed.
So that's
not representing Republicans. You are
right.
The county clerk for all folks.
Right.
Okay.
So
regardless of their political affiliation.
Right. So the Republican.
But that's not what he said. He said that it was the folks under Jack. It was their fault that the election wasn't fair, free, and honest. I mean, take for example, you walk into a polling place and there's this little yellow piece of paper that says early voting application. And in the middle of the page, in the largest print on the page, bold, is John A. Cunningham, County Clerk, Kane County, Illinois. Now, if I walk in with my polo shirt that has Doug Warlick for Kane County Clerk, I'm not allowed in there. That's electioneering. So tell me what the purpose is to have your name in large, bold print in the middle of the application that everybody signs just before they get a ballot. To me, that's improper electioneering. It speaks to the heart of free, fair, and honest elections. And that's just one example. We can go on and on. Talk about the vote-by-mail ballots last time. There's roughly 90,000 vote-by-mail ballots, and they were not initialed. So using the resources of the taxpayers of King County, that office was touting the vote-by-mail system, and they were going around with a video. They were going around to all the Republican township meetings, touting how wonderful vote-by-mail ballots are, or vote-by-mail the process is, and look at this machinery we have, and look at how fast it is. And they just go on and on and on about, we have a machine that blows open the envelope, and then we have this machine that just goes through, you know, hundreds in a minute, you know, just, and it says it throws out the ballots that are not signed. And so they finished the whole thing, and I said, so that's why, I asked the question, so that's why there were no initials on the vote-by-mail ballots. So, you know, they just pause. They don't know what to say, this long, pregnant pause. I said, because you never viewed them, because you let the machine look at them. I mean, obviously, you can't have election judges viewing the signatures when they're going through this machine at this rapid pace that they're talking about.
So then, what is the change that you would make to the Kane County Clerk's Office to make sure that there is
voter integrity, or
the enforcement required to ensure free and fair elections?
Well, there are a lot of changes. You can look at the provisional ballots that's required by the Illinois Election Code. And in the last election, Jack announced that the day of, on election day, says there'll be no provisional ballots. You know, I asked him about that, and his explanation was, well, they take too long. It takes like 15 minutes to investigate a provisional ballot. For the folks that don't understand a provisional ballot, those are the ballots that should be set aside, and they're counted and looked at if there could be a difference in the race, if there's enough of them. King County was the only county that didn't have provisional ballots of all the large counties in the state. Even Cook County did. And to make that decision, I call it whimsical, because you're not entitled to do that. When somebody comes in, for example, and they are told, well, you can't vote because you submitted a vote-by-mail application, so you've already voted. And they said, no, I didn't, or I didn't get it. You're supposed to surrender the vote-by-mail ballot, and then you can vote with a provisional ballot. You sign an affidavit. Well, what the office has done is they put in their election judge manual telling the election judges to lie to – and I'm not kidding about that. That sounds like a strong word, doesn't it? Coming from an attorney, I should know better. But they do. They tell them to lie. It says even if the voter didn't come in with a vote-by-mail ballot to surrender it, say that they did. And this is – and he's since – since I put that in my literature and since it became a public knowledge, I understand that he's pulled that manual down off the website. But I have a copy of the manual. I have a copy of the direction telling the election judges to lie. And that's the kind of thing that he does. He says, well, it's the same day voting, so you don't need a provisional ballot. Well, you do when the election code tells you to. And the election code says if somebody comes in and they had a vote-by-mail ballot, you have to let them vote, you know, with a provisional ballot. So there's things like that. And what we need to do is we need to have complete transparency. We need to have situations where it's not the speed of the process, it's the accuracy. If provisional ballots take 15 minutes, so be it. If it takes longer to actually view the signatures of the voters, compare them, make sure they're accurate, then initial it, go through the extra process and do it. What about
Doug, are you afraid that he's going to steal the election from you?
I'm not the sort of person that jumps out in left field and makes wild allegations. Mm-hmm. But I know for a fact that there were improprieties in the 2020 election, and they're continuing this election. I know that election judges denied poll watchers the ability to do their job in the Aurora satellite office I think it was about 2 weeks ago. And I just mentioned the manual telling the election judges to lie. So there are things that are going on that deprive all of the candidates of a fair election. I'm not really addressing it for me.
Yeah.
I'm addressing it for everybody.
In Kane County, since you know, you're both running as Republicans, and so whoever wins will be in the – ostensibly, if you win a general election, that's competitive now these days in Kane County. You know, I haven't been bowled over – by the leadership of the Kane County Republican Party in some time. So is the reason that Republicans are losing in Kane County, is it because of the way elections are being administered, or is it because of the moribundness of the GOP there?
It's a loaded question, and I appreciate that. Now, I'll just say both. It is time for new leadership, but that's really another subject for another day. The election integrity is clearly an issue. I mean, go back. The jokes were always about Chicago and Cook County. You know, you voted twice. You voted dead people vote. All that. All those jokes were about Cook County. There shouldn't be questions. People should feel secure that their elections are honest. I mean, I'm 65, and I never ever thought that elections weren't completely fair and honest. I never had questions historically, and look what's going on now. Why are people questioning the elections? And it's not just a Trump phenomenon. It's that there are all these questions, things that are happening that shouldn't be happening. People need to do their job, and you know that office is not being properly handled at the top, much like the analogy I gave earlier with Biden.
And you're not an election attorney. You're an attorney in private practice, not an election attorney, right?
That's correct. Yeah, I've been an attorney since 1981. I've done a lot of trial work, principally family law work. I am going to take my energy and passion and bring it to the clerk's office and fix things, you know, to correct things, to make the kinds of changes need to be done. Bring fresh ideas. What about doing a random audit of, you know, with the paper count of a precinct and see if it matches up, and if it doesn't, then keep going.
What about
a blue ribbon committee?
Well, I don't know about blue ribbon committees, but what about the maintenance of the voter rolls and to make sure that,
oh my gosh,
you know, that to me seems to be a big issue. I mean, generally speaking, I don't know specifically about Kane County. I'm just saying generally speaking.
Oh my gosh, that is the source of the biggest issues and the largest issues in 2020, were the voter rolls, which there is just no effort to clean them up. That would be number one. Going to do that immediately. Whether I have to send one letter or two letters to each registered voter, whatever the law requires, my intention is to make it easy for everybody to vote, but at the same time, purge all of the improperly registered voters. And anybody involved in elections that looks at their precincts, that looks at the voter rolls, can look at a page and see, oh my gosh, that person moved a long time ago, or those children don't live here anymore. They went to college, they don't live, then they moved away. That person died. And you look at, and that's not even considering the fraudulent parts of you know, allegedly there's 23 families living at this apartment building or registered voters, to, you know, in vacant lots. But we can definitely clean them up, and that would really address many of the issues. I think that the vote by mail is closely linked with the horrible voter rolls. They need to be cleaned.
He is Doug Warlick. He is a attorney in private practice in Geneva. He is a candidate, Republican candidate for Kane County Clerk on Tuesday's ballot. Doug, is there a website for more information on your candidacy?
There is. Warlick, the number 4, KaneCountyClerk.com. And I would encourage everybody to vote early this weekend. I mean, this is a kind of a queer election time with the, middle of summer. You might be going golfing on Tuesday. You might be going to fishing or swimming. And, one of the nice things is that voting early is very easy right now. It's even voting this Saturday and Sunday all day. So I think that's a credit, and that should happen. I think people need to get to the polls as soon as they can. Our constitutional republic is because we consent to be governed by the folks that govern us. That means you have to get out and vote.
All right.
Those who govern you.
All right. Doug Warlick, Republican candidate for Kane County Clerk. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Open mic. Open mic Friday.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, taking your calls, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line on this Open Mic Friday. Your comments, compliments, criticism, general crack pottery, we'll take it all. And get people's reaction, too, to the big news yesterday in advance of the final Republican gubernatorial debate that was hosted by your very own AM560. The news that Ken Griffin is pulling up stakes at Citadel and taking his corporate headquarters down to Miami, where he already has a footprint, citing a number of reasons over, frankly, the last several years as to why he was moving towards the exit sign, beginning with public safety.
Yep, and here he is talking about Governor Pritzker.
It is a disgrace that our governor will not insert himself into the challenge of addressing crime in our city.
And his security detail was attempted carjacking on them. He had a few employees who were, one was stabbed walking to work in broad daylight. And he lives downtown. He lives near Chicago and State, and there's mass shootings and riots all the time. Why would he stay here?
Yeah, it's just unfortunate. He got such bad political advice, and maybe in part he doesn't have finely tuned political instincts either, given some of the choices he's made. But I'll ascribe that at least initially to his primary gatekeeper, this Kasen Carter guy, and then these Rahner consultants who, you know, by the way, have a reputation. They didn't just show up, who sold them a bill of goods, sold him a bill of goods, and blew him through all these red lights on Richard Ervin, who they now concede is a dead man walking politically.
But he didn't even wait until Tuesday's primary. He just got up and quit and got up and left.
Yeah, I don't think he wants to be here when the, you know, I don't think he wants to be in the blast zone. And and also, you know, I mean, and he's probably frustrated. I mean, all the things coming out internally about that campaign. Now, all of a sudden, they're complaining about whether or not the Rahner consultants pay themselves too much money. You know, after running a campaign predicated on one lie to set up the next lie, if the first lie didn't work and none of it worked. So, you know, all this dissension in the ranks and upset that everybody didn't fold in with what he was told was the best play and simply isn't the best play. And these are competitive exercises. And so, you know, as I've said before, too bad, so sad. You have to make a case and run a campaign, and perhaps what you thought won't turn out to be true about how that's going to unfold. And if you are committed to basically listening to people who have brought the party to its superminority status in Illinois, because, you know, they are the ones who've been in charge for most of the past 40 years, then, you know, you don't want to chart a different course. You don't want to present contrast. Well, and now, boy, a lot of those folks that were on Ken Griffin's dole, boy.
Well, what's going to happen to them?
They got to start singing for their supper again. They may have public offices, but, you know, finally you might start to clean out some of this feckless leadership in the Republican Party and have a Republican Party that respects itself and respects the electorate and is going to make arguments and take the fight politically to the Chicago Democrats and others. You know,
it's a huge loss for the city. I mean, anytime the bike pack was broken, you know, during the pandemic, and I mean, he came forward and he fixed it. He just paid it.
Yes.
Like, let's fix it. But him alone, he makes what he's worth, $25 billion. Him alone, tax revenue for the city of Chicago, $200 million a year. According to the Washington Free Beacon.
That's what the company he has, as well as individually. And all that's, yeah, I get it. Right. It's big hits. It's not good. Nobody is suggesting, I mean, I don't know anybody.
I don't know anybody suggesting
it is good.
Right.
And so the question is, especially after a 3-week run of Boeing, Caterpillar, Citadel, you still want to stay the course? I don't know. I think it's you know, better than a 50-50 proposition that the state will stay the course. meaning the course of pushing productive people and their enterprises out of the state. We'll see.
I'm afraid we're going to become Detroit. Because you said months ago, I said, well, we're going to become Detroit. And you said, no, we're not, as long as Ken Griffin and Citadel's still here.
Well, and what it's more than that. It includes Citadel. But, you know, as Chicago has diversified over the last several generations, since it was a meatpacking and manufacturing center, financial services, the exchanges, insurance, it's big accounting, big accounting firms. I mean, those are big enterprises, and they're interlinked. And you're losing agribusiness companies. You're losing financial services companies of significance. There's a lot of, you know, to use the old automotive comparison, there's a lot of, you know, first and second and third tier suppliers to those big operations. Again, in 2020 alone, there was something like $3 billion worth of income that left Illinois for Florida. That's just Florida. Last year, it was, what, 105,000 people with $10 billion in income that left? So you're talking about successful people making six-figure salaries that are gone. So it's not just Ken, and it's not just all the employees at Citadel. I mean, it's that ripple effect. And it's also what's going on beyond him and has been going on for a decade. These huge companies with the big names, they make a bigger splash when they go. But all those other little pebbles have, you know, a aggregate impact that is similar when you project it out over the decade that it's been happening, more than a decade. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Ryan in New Lenox.
Hey, Dan and Amy. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to run through my thoughts on the debate last night real fast. I'm going to go in order of least relevant to most relevant. Okay, Schimpf, he just sounds like a company man. Dan, I was getting flashbacks to your debate with Pat Brady a few years ago. We need to unite the Republican Party. Unite the party. Unite the party. That's all he had to say. Rabine seemed like a good guy. Seems like I like a lot of his fiscal policy. But why was he screaming the whole night? He was just shouting. Okay, Sullivan, I think he's a smarmy politician. I think he was giving smarmy political oppo research dump answers. He offered a bunch of vague aphorisms. We're going to fix this. We're going to change that. We're going to help this. We're going to restore that. But no concrete policy proposals. And then Bailey, who I'm voting for, he was a punching bag last night, which shows that he's the leader. I thought he did a good job generally, but Dan, I'm curious to get your feedback on this. I think he needs to tighten up the preciseness of his answers and getting to concrete policy proposals in his answers. And what struck me, I think that a debate with 90-second intervals is kind of the worst format for his speech patterns. Whereas Sullivan and people like Sullivan and Irvin, that's the best you can find them, is that 90-second soundbite. But Bailey, you sit him down and talk for an hour, I feel like you'd have a much greater understanding as opposed to the 90-second soundbite. So thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Ryan. I mean, I generally agree with those observations. I think it's useful for Bailey to be in that environment where he, you know, took some fire from Rabine and from Sullivan, because you got to learn to be a street fighter and you got to learn to be good in the moment, in real time, in a debate setting. He's going to need to improve his debate performances and improve his skill in that sort of format in the general election. And he's going to have a short time to do it because we got a short run from, you know, July to the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. Frank, Arlington Heights.
Dan, Amy, you are making fun of my great city. Out here in Wayne County, I have a lot of muffler shops and I have a lot of other businesses to run. I am, of course, the doctor. Dr. Detroit.
Dr. Cavorkian.
Why do you consistently make fun of my city?
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's pretty good, Frank. I could tell you put some work into that one.
I've been doing that one since like 86 or something like that. So I saw that.
You've perfected it. Yeah, very good.
You nailed
very
it.
Very good.
One other point I wanted to make too about the guy you had on with Kane County Kirk, Mr. Warlick. You know, he mentioned about early voting. Just as, you know, a conservative, I think early voting is horrible. I think we should have voting on one day. That's it. You lose out on a lot of information when you vote early, when we're voting 4 weeks early. And out here in Cook County, we have, in Wheeling Township, we've reduced the number of precincts from like over 80. I used to do the signs for all the different precincts and so forth. And so it was over 80 15, 20 years ago. Now it's in the 60s. We keep consolidating these precincts. And then, of course, that's an excuse. We don't have, you know, we don't have enough polling places. We got to have early voting. And then, you know, I mean, you don't know who to vote for 3 weeks in advance. Then, of course, they come out and they say something stupid, and then you regret it. I vote on election day at the polling place. We should have all paper ballots. If you don't want to vote on that day and you have an excuse, you get an absentee ballot. But that's it. Anyway, that's my opinion on the whole thing.
I am with you on that, Frank. I mean, you know, maybe I could go the weekend before or something like that when, you know, everything that's more or less going to be said or mailed out or seen on TV has been done. But, yeah, I agree with you. This early voting 4 weeks out is
ridiculous.
It is nonsense. It's not helpful.
It's a vulnerable system. The longer you keep it up and running.
And frankly, you know, it's really limited evidence to suggest it has a significant impact in overall turnout. It just distributes the turnout over four weeks, I should say. It doesn't significantly change it. So I'm in total agreement. Bob, Naperville.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Thanks for taking my call. Really quickly, great show, great guest, and I think you guys are, you're my best source of news, so thank you and keep up the good work. My quick comment has to do with the recent development at Kirkland and Ellis. You know, had Paul Clement and Aaron Murphy represented a marshmallow company at the Supreme Court and won, they'd be heroes. But that victory would be short-lived as well once the woke brain trust at Kirkland and Ellis realized all marshmallows are white. You know, they would require all future legal work for marshmallow companies be multicolored product line. Mm-hmm. It's just nonsense. But again, great show. Keep up the good work, guys.
Thanks, Bob. Eduardo at Midway.
Yeah, I plan on voting on Tuesday. I don't believe in these early voting Democrats. They want to have 24-hour voting so they get their favorable results. I wanted to comment on the ambassadors that I saw yesterday on TV. You know, I didn't see too many like bilingual people out there. You know, like
I mean, the street ambassadors,
Spanish or Polish, right? Right.
Down Michigan Avenue, the show and tell that Lori Lightfoot did last night. Showing that we're safe now because we have these people, these street ambassadors, and the you know, and the neon yellow vests walking around.
Yeah.
So if tourists need help, they run to the street ambassador.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Are the street ambassadors armed? No, they are not.
The street ambassadors are like the safe passage ambassadors, are like the traffic management aides.
Yeah.
You know what we need? We need fewer police and we need more ambassadors, aides, assistants, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, to be an ambassador, an aide, or an assistant of some sort, you just have to know the right alderman. You don't have to go to the academy.
Right,
you don't have to put your life on the
so.
Line or anything like that. I mean, it's something. Thanks for the call, Eduardo. The street ambassadors, it just never ends. These civilian corps, civilian patronage corps, and all the
and a lot of them
tentacles.
The same people used to go door to door promoting vaccinations.
Oh,
they're
sure.
Wearing the same yellow because I went to that press conference. They're wearing the same yellow vest.
The
COVID knockers.
Yeah, the COVID.
We heard you haven't been vaccinated because, you know.
The COVID jackboots. Yeah,
we'll come to you. We'll be here tomorrow and we'll give you $100.
Oh, the COVID captains, right? The COVID captains
for your
block party like you are.
You're going to my block party. You're gonna
not.
Christen the bouncy house.
I am not. I don't think I can go north of.
Of what? Chicago Avenue?
No, I can go a little north of that. I can't go north of like North Avenue anymore. I can't do it.
Okay.
I don't want to. Terry, Rogers Park.
Yeah, I don't see anything wrong with Sullivan mentioning God in the debate. God needs to be mentioned once in a while.
Okay. I don't think it was him mentioning it once in a while. I think it was him mentioning it every other answer was the criticism. But, yeah, okay. Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Hi, good morning. You know, the federal elections, well, November elections fall on my birthday all the time. Maybe that's why I'm so into the politics thing, because I a lot going on and it's so much fun. Anyway, I want to remind people to protect themselves when they go out. Everyone should take a self-defense course sometime in their life, especially women and teenagers. It'll help make you less of a target for these crazy crimes. Lock your doors when you go to the pump. You know, my car, all the door locks open. that's just a Toyota thing, I think. But take your purses and bags out of the car. Western Springs and Hinsdale have been a huge carjacking target, suburbs, for years. Right,
you know,
Amy?
You know what? Yep. You know what Western Springs and Hinsdale needs?
What?
Oh, street ambassadors.
Street ambassadors.
Right. I can't believe I didn't think of that. But, you know, this is the thing. It's your life is in danger now. We keep watching it on the news. Everyone's scared to death. You know, I go to Costco and not only are these young ladies trying to go to work crying when they fill up their big cars, they leave their purses on the seat. And I'm like, just lock your passenger door. And then they can't get in. Maybe they won't get you. They
might, right.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know, Dion. What do you think?
Thanks for the call, Mary Kay. I think we got to go.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.